These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Buddhism Part 2. Lecture 13, Buddhist Philosophy.
After my last lecture, I hope you feel intrigued and maybe even a little bit curious about the concept of emptiness. But I suspect, if I gauge your mood correctly after that long discussion of that difficult concept, that you also may be a little bit intimidated. It's not common, I think it's not common, in the religious traditions of the world to hear that everything is possible precisely because everything is unreal. This way of speaking is meant to give you pause, and it's meant to make you think in new ways about ordinary experiences. And I think, although I'm probably imposing my own imagination a little bit on the past in this respect, I think that this is what the Buddha actually intended when he began to speak about the concept of no-self. In this lecture, I want to push the study of emptiness a step further by looking at some of the ways Indian Buddhist philosophers have tried to pin down the meaning of emptiness. The study of Buddhist philosophy, unfortunately, is not particularly easy. The concept of emptiness already presents formidable difficulties to us, and these difficulties are only compounded by the technical style of argument that's favored by the philosophers in classical India. Buddhist philosophical texts, the ones that we beat our heads against when we study this tradition, were produced in a sophisticated monastic environment, and they often relied on a lot of technical discourse that now seems impenetrable to us, even in some of the best translations. It's not always easy to get at, particularly in the original languages either. But I think it's worth spending the space of at least one of our precious lectures grappling with the work of these philosophers. As it would be to grapple with the work of a sophisticated Jewish or Christian philosopher. And the reason for this, I think, should be pretty clear. A careful intellectual account of any religious tradition is going to help clarify for us what the basic ideas and basic problems are of the tradition. And more importantly, especially in the case of a tradition like Buddhism that really isn't familiar to us in a lot of ways, it helps us identify where the intellectual problems actually lay for Buddhists, not just where they lie for us as outside observers, but for the practitioners of the tradition themselves. So it's worth grappling a bit, I think, with the difficulties of this philosophical tradition. Now, where do we start? Maybe the best place is with a pretty basic question. What do we mean when we use the word Buddhist philosophy? Philosophy is a Western word, of course. It comes to us from the Greek. What do we mean when we use that word in a Buddhist setting? Now, the most common word that we're translating when we use this English word, philosophy, to talk about the Indian tradition, is a word that means simply vision. It's the word darshana. We've already seen that the word darshana is used to name the emotionally charged vision of an image in Buddhist worship. I said a few lectures ago that often when you go into worship in an Indian temple, there's a moment that is really quite dramatic when the door or the curtain is closed that covers the central image in the temple, and then there's a big banging of drums and a ringing of bells and all that sort of thing, and psht, the curtain is pulled aside and you have a look directly at the image. This image, this vision of the image is called darshana. It's taking the darshan of the image, as we often say in English, and it's a powerful and important emotional moment in Buddhist worship, as in Hindu worship and the worship of other religious traditions in India. This is actually what the word philosophy means. It's darshana. It's seeing ultimate reality face to face. And in a lot of ways, it's similar to this emotionally charged vision of a deity, because you're confronting ultimate reality with a certain kind of sensory directness. You see it, and it affects you. So that's what philosophy is meant in, I suppose, an etymological sense, to do, but it also, of course, has very practical implications for Buddhists as well. In my lecture on the path to nirvana, I mentioned that the path could be divided into three categories: sila, which was moral conduct, samadhi, mental concentration, and punya. Well, another word for philosophy is a word, vipassana, a word that we sometimes translate as discriminating vision or insight. It's a form of Buddhist meditation, and it has to do with cultivating wisdom, and it, too, is a kind of philosophy. So philosophy, like insight meditation, is one of the ways to cultivate wisdom. So it is integrally related to the practice of Buddhism itself, something that you have to do to try to free yourself from the illusions that bind you in the world of death and rebirth, the world of samsara. So this means that philosophy is not just a theoretical activity, it's a form of Buddhist practice. You might say that Buddhist philosophy is, these are my words, not words that belong to the Buddhists, but I think it makes sense. You could say that Buddhist philosophy is practice seeking clarification, in the same way that Christian theologians say that theology is faith seeking understanding. But the clarification of the mind that we're talking about here is not just a little intellectual game. It's not something that you play with students in a class just to have fun, just to play intellectual tricks. Philosophy helps a person see through the appearances of things and confront reality face to face, as if you were looking at that image in the temple. Now, I also should say that the practice of philosophy in Buddhist communities, especially in the Tibetan world, is practical in another sense, too. Whether this was true back in the Indian communities that first gave us this tradition, we really don't know. But if you go to visit a Tibetan monastery these days, whether it's in Tibet or in the mountains of India or down on the plains where there are some major Tibetan monasteries that have been reestablished in Tibetan refugee communities, there's a fantastic little ritual that kids go through when they first practice this philosophical tradition. When you get up in the morning, I don't remember how early that was, but when you get up in the morning, you go off and have some breakfast, some Tibetan buttered tea, and maybe some sampa, some barley, or something like that. And then you go to your teacher, and the teacher, in I guess the most elementary sense, gives you a text to memorize. He recites a text to you, and the young monks have the job of memorizing it, simply absorbing the teaching as if they were memorizing in that classic Indian sense. It's associated with an oral tradition of teaching throughout the Indian world. And then they have to go out and debate it. That's really where the philosophy enters, in a sense, where they have to engage in argument to try to explore some of the ambiguous points in the teaching that's just been presented to them and learn how to make their position effective in relation to others. And if you ever get a chance to visit in a Tibetan community, this is probably one of the most lively and interesting moments in the whole day. Oftentimes, there's a row of young monks lined up with their in the shady side of the temple with their back up against the temple wall. And then there's another line of young monks, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, whatever their age would be. And they're the questioners in the debate. So they stand there. They've often got a little rosary in their hand. And it becomes kind of like, I don't know, it's like recess or it's like PE practice or something like that. These guys who are standing up, starting to the debate, line up their opponent, and they start to ask some questions like, okay, something. Is the self identical to the aggregates or is it not? Ha! Sa! Give me an answer. And then the answer comes back and the answer is translated into another question. So philosophy becomes this tremendous game with stamping of feet, great sort of peals of laughter. It's as active a form of intellectual discipline as I think I've ever seen anywhere in the religious traditions of the world. So philosophy is practical in a sense in the sense that it cultivates vision, this fundamental form of insight into the nature of reality, but it also is practiced in Buddhist communities in a way that has a certain kind of physicality that's full of physical energy. And in that sense, it's a kind of absorbing component in the practical life of a Buddhist monastery. Now, the goal of all of this, of course, is to experience the freedom of the Buddha's awakening, to make the Buddha's awakening present in your own experience, not just as an intellectual trick, but as something that you feel in your own experience. And on this point, all Buddhist philosophers agreed, but they did not always agree on the best way to approach the concept of emptiness. And out of the differences that they felt in relation to the concept of emptiness developed two major schools of Buddhist philosophy. It's these schools that we really want to focus on in our discussion of this tradition. The first major school of Mahayana philosophy is known as the Madhyamaka, or the Middle Way School. The Madhyamaka school emerged in India in the 2nd or 3rd century of the Common Era in the works of the philosopher Nagarjuna. It was developed for almost 1,000 years in India, then it was transmitted to Tibet and became the dominant tradition of Tibetan philosophy. So Madhyamaka is the goal of that kind of philosophical practice that I was just, in my own very clumsy way, trying to demonstrate to you. Nagarjuna adhered very closely to the understanding of emptiness that I outlined in the last lecture. So last time we were talking about emptiness in a way that Nagarjuna himself would have understood and found quite familiar. Nagarjuna said, "When the Buddhas teach the Dharma, they make use of two truths, ordinary relative truth and ultimate truth." This is the doctrine of two truths that I mentioned last time. Nagarjuna says, "Anyone who does not know the distinction between these two truths does not know the profound point of the Buddha's teaching. From the point of view of ultimate truth, all things are empty of identity." This is the point we discussed last time. "But from the relative or the conventional point of view," and the words relative and conventional are both used to talk about this second of the two truths, "from the relative or the conventional point of view, the categories of ordinary life have to be accepted as valid." You've got to accept them and you have to work with them. Nagarjuna distilled this point into a simple formula. "It's impossible to teach ultimate truth without relying on conventional truth. And without understanding the ultimate, it's impossible to attain nirvana." I almost think I ought to find some way to debate this with you, but it's not easy to do in the setting that we're presently in. Now, the key point of controversy for Nagarjuna's commentators, for the people who came after Nagarjuna and had to explain him and begin to work with his basic ideas, key point of controversy had to do with the meaning of the word rely. What does it mean, they asked, to rely on conventional truth when you make some kind of statement about ultimate truth? It was a basic split in the Madhyamaka tradition on this rather technical point. One group of followers, who were known as the Swatantrikas, thought that they had to accept that things were established or proven in a conventional sense before they could argue against them in an ultimate sense. This position came from their belief that philosophers had to start from established premises before they could refute the positions of their opponents. And this position is actually embodied and expressed in the name of this group. The word Swatantrika comes from a Sanskrit word, Swatantra, that means independent. And the Swatantrikas were people who felt that Madhyamakas, the followers of Nagarjuna, had to make independent arguments in order to respond to the positions of their opponents. And in order to make an independent argument, you had to state a premise that you felt was valid, and then you had to use that premise to argue to a conclusion. So they felt that conventional reality had to be established. It had to be proven at the start of an argument in order to move forward in the debating process to convince their opponents of a position that they wanted the opponent eventually to adopt. That's the position of the Swatantrikas. It had a lot of influence in India and also in Tibet, but it wasn't the one that eventually won the day, at least from the Tibetan point of view. Another group of followers were known as the Prasangikas. They thought that they only needed to presuppose the positions of their opponents before showing that they led to absurd conclusions. This position, too, is embodied in the name of their subschool, the name of their branch of the Madhyamaka. The word Prasangika comes from the word prasanga, that means an absurd conclusion. So all they do is take the words of their opponents and then show that the position of their opponents will lead to some kind of an absurd conclusion. In other words, they don't themselves accept the validity of anything that the opponent has to say. They maintain no positions of their own. They simply take their opponent's words and lead them to some kind of an absurd conclusion. Now, you might be wondering at this point, I think, why we're going into this in so much detail. One wonders this always when you study Buddhist philosophy. We have now followed the argument about the true truths into what is genuinely a technical, intramural dispute between two groups of commentators in the Madhyamaka school. So we've got to ask ourselves, what's at stake here? Why is it interesting for us to consider an argument like this? Was lively in India 1,300 years ago. Why is it something that's intriguing for us in our own study of the Buddhist tradition? I think, convinced, that there's a good answer to this question. This is a way for us to focus with what I would call a fine philosophical precision on the meaning of the words that ended the Dalai Lama's explanation of the self. In my last lecture, I said that the Dalai Lama concluded his long discussion about the self, a discussion that was puzzling to a lot of his audience. He ended it by referring to himself with a smile, with a certain kind of lightness, with a twinkle in his eye. He referred to himself as the mere self, or just me. The Tibetan word for just me is daktsam, merely the self. Now, what does it mean to say precisely, in a philosophical sense, just me? The Prasangikas say that this simple phrase refers to the self in a way that attributes absolutely no substantial identity to it. It's a phrase, as they say, and this is really a technical definition for them. It's a phrase that satisfies only when it is not analyzed, when you don't ask precisely what that word refers to. In other words, it's a phrase that only works when you don't ask whether there is any real thing that lies behind the words. Now, if you've been listening carefully to all of my comments about the Buddhist concept of no-self, it's come up again and again for us through the course of these lectures, you'll understand that this simple phrase, no self, expresses the key point in the Buddhist view of the world. Buddhists want to find a way to live in the world, respond to it emotionally, and take it seriously intellectually, but not be bound by any of it. And this requires a delicate balance between the two intellectual poles of the middle path. Not too much self and not too little self. You need just enough to be effective and at the same time to be free. And this is what the Madhyamaka school was trying to get at when it was doing this fine little exegesis of the concept of conventional reality. Because conventional reality, of course, is what we mean by self, right? I mean, what am I but just some kind of conventional entity that stands here and jabbers away about Buddhist philosophy? It's all conventionality. None of it is ultimately real. But how is it real, right? I mean, that's the question. How can you be a self in a way that is forceful? It's out there saying stuff, but at the same time, not be anything at all. The Dalai Lama says, well, I'm just me. The Prasangikas would say, well, you know, you have to be in a sense that, in a self in a sense that satisfies only when it's not analyzed. You can't be a self that is established in any way in its own right, either from the ultimate point of view or the conventional point of view, because if you were, you'd be holding on to that self. And you wouldn't be able to flow freely through the flow of experience. So the issue that lies behind this funny little intramural dispute between the Prasangikas and the Swatantrikas, the two branches of the Madhyamaka school, is really a dispute about selfhood, and in the end it's a dispute about freedom. How you can define for yourself philosophically what it means to be free and still an active and serious participant in all of the experience that we share. This is the Madhyamaka school, the school of the middle path, and it is, I think you can say quite confidently, the fundamental position of the Tibetan tradition. It's a position that is shared by all Tibetan schools in one way or another, without exception. Now, the second major school in the Indian tradition, the second major interpretation of emptiness, the second variety of Mahayana philosophy, is known as the Yogacara, or the Yoga Practice School. The Yogacara school was founded in the 4th century by Asanga, Mahayana philosopher, with help from his brother, Vasubandhu. Like the Madhyamaka, the Yogacara school had a long and active history in India. At the beginning of the 7th century, it was carried to China by the Chinese philosopher Xuanzang, where it had significant impact on the tone and orientation of Chinese Buddhist thought. We'll talk more about the Yogacara when we get to China. Now our job is to understand it as an Indian school. The Yogacara took a position that was quite different from the Madhyamaka. Instead of using a doctrine of two truths to understand emptiness, the Yogacara used a concept of three natures. This was their vision of reality. They thought of ordinary experience, the flow of sensation, the flow of sound, the flow of visual experience, as dependent nature, a kind of reality that arises dependently. Ordinary experience, they said, depends for its existence on a beginningless series of momentary causes and conditions. In some respects, this ordinary experience is real, and in some respects, it's unreal. This is the Yogacara version of the middle path. In some ways, it's there. In some ways, it's not there. Let's ask first how it's not there. The unreal aspect of dependent nature, the Yogacaras called imagined nature. This consists of the concepts and distinctions that we impose on the flow of experience. All the different ways we slice up ordinary experiences conceptually to distinguish one thing from another. This is unreal, they say. The real aspect of dependent nature goes by the name perfected nature. This is the mind itself, devoid of all of these imaginary distinctions. Another name for perfected nature is emptiness itself. Now, the Yogacara philosophers expressed this concept of three natures, in a series of verses. These verses were meant to be memorized as the boys memorized their texts in the Tibetan monasteries and then quoted in debate. To our ears, they sound clumsy and obscure. Often they're quite condensed and seemingly quite technical, but they're quite precise and rhythmic in Sanskrit. And I'm going to quote a little Sanskrit to you to show you that that's the case. In English, one of the most important verses sounds like this. The imagination of something that is unreal is real, but the duality in it is not real. The emptiness in it is real, however, and it is real in emptiness. If that's puzzling, let me read the Sanskrit to you. So at least you can sound, so that you can hear the sound of this verse in its original rhythm. It actually has a wonderful conciseness and a rhythmic quality that makes it easy to memorize. Don't worry that whether there's going to be a test on any of this. There's no Sanskrit test that somehow lies at the end of this course. The verse sounds like this. Abhuta parikalposti dvayan tatra navidyate, shunyata vidyate tu atra tasyam api savidyate. You can see how it would be nice to be an 8-year-old Tibetan monk to quote this as you were standing there debating with your opponent. It's rhythmic and it's clear. The problem for us, of course, is to try to get that clarity somehow to come through the words. And for us, I think the best way to make sense of the Yogacara vision of the world is to look really at their examples rather than their technical concepts. They have actually some rather clear ways of speaking about their vision of reality. Sometimes they compare dependent nature to a dream. All the phantoms in the dream may be unreal, but no one would doubt the reality of the mind that does the dreaming. So the dreaming mind, unreal insofar as it's creating this phantom universe, real in the process of dreaming itself. Dependent nature also can be compared to a stormy ocean. Imagined nature is like the separate waves on the ocean, and perfected nature is like the deep stillness of the ocean itself. Meditation is meant to still the waves so that the pure, undifferentiated nature of the mind can become clear. Another possibility is to compare the mind to a jewel hidden in a dung heap. Meditation is meant to help find the jewel and clean away the defilements. And when I teach about the Yogacara, I'm struck by two things about it. The first is how it turns the Madhyamaka understanding of the world right upside down. The Madhyamaka insisted that ultimately nothing is real, including emptiness itself. The Yogacara says that the mind is real, and it's only the imaginary construction of the mind that's unreal. It's just turned right upside down. Very interesting. The second surprising thing about this position is that it seems in a lot of ways to make intuitive sense. Isn't it true that we can doubt the reality of all the images we create with the mind? But how can we doubt the reality of the mind itself? In some ways, that's the basic Yogacara insight. So why did the Yogacara take a position that seems so radically opposed to the position of the Madhyamaka? Their deep motivations are pretty hard to discern, but they tell us themselves that there were really two reasons. First of all, to take the goal of the Buddhist path seriously, you have to be convinced that it's real, that it's there in some way for you to aspire to. In this case, the goal is the complete purification of the mind. But in order to reach the goal, you have to be convinced that all of the barriers that stand between you and the goal can in some way actually be overcome. To say that duality is unreal, as they do in that puzzling little verse that I just read, means that the illusions that tie people to the world of samsara are nothing but a dream. And all we have to do to achieve Buddhahood is to simply wake up from that dream and let that unreality slip away. So the Yogacara, too, was motivated by the pursuit of nirvana. Now, it's this conviction about the reality of the mind that seems to have made the Yogacara attractive to the Chinese. The Yogacara school still does not exist, or doesn't exist still, as a separate entity today in China or in Japan, except for a few Hosso monasteries in Japan. But its ideas infused the Chinese tradition, and we'll encounter them again in all sorts of ways when we turn to China, especially in the tradition of Zen.